You can walk into a room and you can think, well, nobody knows I'm here and I'm lonely and nobody really cares about me and nobody would want to talk to me. These sort of thoughts can go through our head. Or we can walk into a room and we can think, I wonder who is here that needs a word of encouragement. I wonder who I can get next to tonight and ask some questions and begin to draw them out. Find out where they are and to see if there's some way that I can meet a need in their life. There are just two different ways of approaching it. The first way, we're focusing in on ourselves and how we feel and what others are not doing to us that we feel we have coming. And that tends to give us a low self-image. We don't feel good about ourselves because we're depending too much on feedback from other people as to who we are. And the other way, we're on the offensive. We're reaching out to others and we're taking the responsibility to try to do something for them. So our focus is completely off of ourselves and onto other people. And boy, I tell you, that makes a world of difference. And for a shy, quiet little girl to learn to do that has taken years of prayer and letting God do some breaking, which, by the way, He's got a lot more to do, but at least we're on our way in my own life. And it has been a very freeing up experience for me, though, just to force myself out of those self-centered ruts and get into the mainstream of what God is doing in life. And quite frankly, people are not that interested in what we're doing. I mean, if we want the attention to focus on us, I think we are going to be disappointed. I think we are always going to feel like we're coming up short. I heard Betty Davis on television interviewing, no, I read it in a magazine. She was giving out Oscars a few months ago, and she was the MC. And people gave her a standing ovation because she had been a great actress in years gone by. And when they finished applauding, she said, you know, this makes me realize how starved I have been for this kind of attention, and I think I'm going to get back more into the spotlight of things. And I thought as I read that, I thought, boy, all of her affirmation and her sense of self-worth came from other people. And if it was not there, she didn't feel good about herself. And if the applause was there, then she felt good about herself. And I thought, boy, I don't want my life to be on a shaky foundation like that. I want my self-worth to come from what God says. And I want to be in on the mainstream of what He's doing in this world. And quite frankly, He has put me here not to get, but to give. He's put me here to be reaching out to other people, to be asking questions, to be ministering to them. And the focus is not to be on me, but it's to be on what God is doing in this world. And that I can tie in and be a part of that if I choose to be. And it has a whole lot to do with your sense of worth, how you feel about yourself, because you're right where God wants you to be. Let's just stop right now and kind of throw this open for any questions or comments that you'd like to share yourself. There are a lot of gaps here. There's so much that we haven't covered and there just isn't time to, but let's just, anything maybe that has come to your mind that you'd like to share.
Yeah. I have a question. Could you give us a message again in the repairing part of Exodus? You talked about if we do the right thing that we are still going to make it.
Now that was Genesis 4, 6, and 7. Uh-huh. Genesis 4, 6, and 7. And then the Exodus one, I think, was Exodus 4, 10.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that it? Uh-huh.
Okay.
About Moses, you mean?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. Exodus 4, 7. What are some areas that you all struggle with, if you feel free to share anything? That you find it difficult in this area, self-image. You don't come across that way, Diana.
Yeah.
Let's
see, I get your name, Susan.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's Diana right there. Yeah. Susan.
And that's
okay. We're women. We're just emotional creatures. That's okay.
I mean, that's kind of very difficult to double message. People tell you, don't worry, this is important. But then you get on the case that don't have normal coordination.
Normal coordination.
I'm myself a boy.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And people say, it's okay, this mess, just again, but at the same time, come on, you can do better than that.
Yeah,
definitely about bowling. My sister, I'm trying to bowl in me. My first ball, I ran down and I fell. My second ball, I threw it behind me. My third ball was a gutter ball.
I threw it on my foot once.
I dropped it behind me and had to roll the other way.
Well, you know, these are areas now for God where we, our feeling is one of inadequacy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We just feel like, Lord, I just can't cope with this area, and this is humiliating to me, and it's unnerving to me. What are our alternatives when we face an area like that in our lives? What are our options?
And you should start a positive with it. Number one, I am a Christian. Number two, love.
Mm-hmm.
And you send it out someplace so you can have a positive presence. Staring in the face every day.
Or like Ephesians says, I'm accepted in the beloved. God accepts me. But you know, we can do one of two things. We can either become bitter over what God has not given us, or we can say, Lord, every time this happens, I'm going to thank you that this is another opportunity to learn brokenness. And for you to build humility and meekness in my life. So we can go one of two routes, can't we, on that?
It seems like every time I sign up to a close fellowship with God, something happens, or I have to travel a lot, and I do pretty well considering that, you know, he didn't know I should travel a lot, but five people don't travel long. And recently I talked about 7 days, and that was during the thing with Olivia, and I'm scary at home, and I had some. Had a bad experience with her this week on with some friends, and I thought with friends, and for me sometimes it's like, I find it difficult because I have a tendency, not for saying, to expect or to look to others for approval, and when I feel rejected in any way, then I immediately start thinking, I start saying, writing a list of all things I must have done wrong, or how I could be wrong, or, you know, how I'm a bad friend, and I rely so much on what other people perceive, how they perceive me. And every time I do that, I get disappointed. I know God must be trying to tell me something, but I think I'm kind of plugged in.
Yeah. Well, you know, the area in my own life that I have struggled with the most in the last 2 years is in the area of motherhood. See, my nest will be emptying in a couple of years. And I have 3 children, and every one of them, when they get into their mid-teens, kind of begins to go off the wall a bit. And I have found myself really struggling with that. Now I've got number 3, he's almost 16. He's a sweet boy, and we have a good relationship with him. But he's to this place where, well, I don't know what I believe, and I'm not sure Christianity is it. And you know, I've got to find my own way. And here I am thinking, Lord, I've prayed all these years. I've done everything I know to raise this child. And Lord, why is it that I have 3 that go through the same thing? Lord, can I have 1 child that can't you give me a reprieve on one? And then I feel inadequate as a mother. And like you were saying, the first thing I want to do is say, well, what did I do wrong? Where did I miss it? And why, God, didn't you make it more clear to me so I could hold this thing off? Yes, it is. And I've had some feelings like that that I've had to confess to the Lord. And he keeps bringing me back to the same place. And that's, why can't you just trust me? The last chapter is not written.
And my parents are really Christians, and all, if this is an encouragement, all 3 of them, they're on the last one also, and all 3 of them, including my husband, went through a period where they really, they pretty seriously, against their parents, against their upbringing and their Christian beliefs. And, well, the 2 eldest ones are both really close to the Lord right now, and love them so much, and both trying to serve them, and my husband's also a little sister in law. Even though they really extremely about it. God made it easy.
But see, all my life I have had a strong feeling about the importance of motherhood. And I can remember back, even before the children were born, saying, Lord, I don't want to bring children to the world unless they can live for you. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do this right. I'm going to pray for my children. I'm going to train them. And so all my focus, see, has, I don't mean that I haven't focused on my husband, but I just mean this has been my role. Mm-hmm. Like my husband has had his job. Mm-hmm. And that gives him fulfillment. And that's, for a man, that's their thing. More, you know, I mean, their family's important, but their main thrust is their work. And for me, this has been my main thrust. And now, see, God allows me to be tested in it. And then the tendency is to squirm.
Your self-image.
My self-image, right. Mm-hmm. And what God is saying to me is, hey, your self-image is too wrapped up in your children. And I insist that it be wrapped up in me. Yeah. And I'm like this, and God is trying to do like that, and, you know, pry those fingers loose. And I'm understanding what he's doing, but I have to admit it's been a struggle. Because he's put his finger on an area of my life that's a very sensitive area. And he had to do that. But you know, we squirm, don't we?
Mm-hmm. God is talking to me and putting the yoke on me, it's really scary. Mm-hmm. I've been wrestling with that for over a year now. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to have children for a long time, we still are. But it just never happened. And there's nothing wrong with just not the right time. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. There's a review of the options to adopt now, and it looks as though we cannot. It doesn't look so good to be able to manage private adoption. So we're going to have to take whatever we can get. And I have to say, reading the register where they have that child for weeks who is 13 years old and punching in a 4-year-old level or has violent tendencies, but with a living family coming up, that's not us at all. Married 3 years and we are trying to continue trying. But they're talking to somebody who's already raised a family. Putting on the guilt of sin. How can you call yourself a parent if you weren't willing to take any trouble?
But then you've got to have God's leading.
It's not God.
That's right. And what God needs you to do, I think there'll be a confidence in it. And also, you want to be able to look back and say, hey, God led me. And that it was not an impulsive decision, but it was God leading me. Yeah, it is interesting how God knows exactly what area of our lives to put his finger on.
What mine was my teaching. I taught school, and after 13 years, really, so to speak, I guess I'd say somebody else raising my kids because they had babysitters, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was just lucky, though, because God had attended that too because I had one day.
They sure did a good job. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when teaching was taken away from me, because after 13 years, the last 2 years before I finally quit, I felt like I didn't want to be there anymore. And that was really, really hard for me because I love teaching. And I thought, why am I having these feelings, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've been out for, 3 years now, I guess, and it's taken me this long to really feel comfortable in having that happen and feeling good about myself now. Mm-hmm. But I can see now what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. That God did that so I would have that close relationship with him, lean on him, you know, for my identity and not the teaching. And then also, I thought, Lord, here my kids are, well, my kids are 12 and 9, you know, and it's like I've been home with them. And I've had some tough struggles with, you know, being a good mother. I've never had the training of that. Here I am at this age. I'm trying to be a good mother. So that's where I am. It's learning to give it over to him. And Sue, as far as you talking about, you know, being the way you are as a kid, I feel like I was that way with Jenny, particularly when she was really little. And I've had to ask forgiveness so much for that. And I've had to ask forgiveness for my kids because of the way I treat them. I really do. I go back and I say, please forgive me.
That is excellent.
Because I just, but the Lord lays that on me. And I know he does. And I just thank you for that too. Because, you know, I feel like through our Christian talk, I'm growing with my kids. It's not, you know, I'm not the parent. Well, I'm the parent physically and you know, that kind of thing. But we're growing together. And I thank God for that.
Well, so, if you can apologize to your children, what you're doing is you're teaching them to do that too.
Yeah.
But if you're never wrong, they know you are, but they learn to never be wrong.
See, that's
too.
What I've had to work through because I felt I had to have to do that. I was never wrong.
I wish I had.
But I'm the same thing. Going down the hall, especially my so like me in so many ways. And maybe that's why Mike and I always get into conflict, mm-hmm. because we love each other.
Yeah.
Well, we're so much alike, we see that mirrored image in each other, and that's caused...
Well, you tend to get impatient with someone like you, because we're impatient with ourselves, and it's a reminder to ourselves of our own. You see that in them, and you say, oh, Lord, I don't want them to be like me, and that's part of me, as far as that goes.
That's true.
But God, just lean on God, Sue, because He'll get you through it, and you're going to grow so much closer.
God heals mine, and He'll clean this planet storm pretty soon. Knock the door. I'm knocking on the door. It's sort of like the knocking on Christ's door to open it. Can I come in, Michael? And either he's thrown on the bed, setting up a fall coming, or his ghetto plaster, turn that on, whatever the situation. And then I sit on the bed and explain why I don't like Michael. I love you, Michael. Well, that'll do it right there.
That's right.
What can we say? Yeah. I got it.
There's a neat book out there, too.
Apologize.
By Harris Molly. It's called, The Key to Your Child's Heart. I'm reading it right now. I said to myself, Lord, why didn't I have this when my kids were younger? I mean, there's a reason for it, as far as that goes. But boy, it's a good book. We're using The Key to Your Child's Heart. I brought it up. It's, we're using it in caring couples at church with feedback. But it's a great book. Mm-hmm.
My mother is so sweet about, she always, fortunately, was such a good girl. She can't come back. But she didn't, she's younger. It's really hard to keep your children. I don't know, getting out of it doesn't have much impact on the person they remember how much you are.
And if you call responsibility. Yeah, my father didn't apologize either, and that's why it was so hard for me to learn to take responsibility. It's because I didn't see that model,
right? Mm-hmm. My husband is really, really good about it. Yeah. He'll take the learning of father's fault. He's just that type. He just doesn't know what happened. When we first got married, it was really difficult for me to get on that excuse myself, especially when I had my own temper. We got temper on him. And it's funny because I don't have as much problems that my son and I have to go to my husband. And fortunately, I'm getting better at it because he's teaching me. He kind of taught me. He's a great example. So I apologize for taking me home. It's really, really sweet.
Why mine is that way, too?
Thinking about
it. You know, when you were talking about anger, and about temper, Susan, it really reminded me of my husband because, I mean, I've never met anyone who is more quick to take responsibility for himself than Jim. There's a humility there, and it has showed me up many times. You know, I just thought, oh, that's such a strength of his life. But he has really struggled with the area of temper over the years, and God has really helped him in it. I mean, today he's miles down the road from where he was when we first got married. But it's something that, like I was saying before, these things don't come overnight and they don't go overnight. But he has worked on it over the years. And when he is wrong, he'll always come back and apologize. And I've seen him many times take responsibility for that. And I've seen him discouraged over it too sometimes. But he hangs in there and he keeps taking the responsibility and apologizing. And God, I've just seen him go from strength to strength to strength over the years because of that. And he's apologized to the children many, many times. And I don't know if he ever abused or anything like that, but the tendency was to preach a sermon and to give too much, expression of disapproval to something that was maybe worth needed about that much instead it got that much, that type of thing. And in each of our lives, there's kind of this area that we feel we can't get on top of. And I know I've done that in my own life. I thought, Lord, all these years, and I'm still not on top of this area of my life. You know, what's wrong? Why aren't you answering prayer? And I asked my husband about that one day. I said, why is it that one area of a person's life or just a dog then over the years. You think, you know, I should have got rid of this long ago, but there it is. And he said, well, he says, I've given that a lot of thought. And he says, I know in my own life that in this particular area it has driven me to God. And he says, that God has used it as a breaking process in my life. And he said, you know, if God answered every prayer immediately, then we would not be broken. We kind of think we did it, and we take some credit for it. But he says he does it in order to build in a brokenness and humility. Now, you can get bitter, you can get hard, you can get resentful, or you can let God break you and make you a more compassionate person. So I think that's why God often will leave an area in our lives for a while and it doesn't go overnight, is because he's doing something more important than just getting rid of that thorn in the flesh. He's teaching you to lean on him. He's teaching you to be humble and to confess and all these things that you never learned if you didn't have that opportunity.
Thank you,
guys.
Wow.
I think
it's a good point. Maybe that's why Paul, Jesus chose to eat the thorn in the flesh for Paul, for us. Because every time we know that, we point out areas just now that are actual thorns. We have to be, if only I didn't raise my temper, if only I didn't fight, only I, you know, correct this and correct that.
Corinthians 4:7 that says we have this treasure in earthen vessels in order that the excellency of the power might be of God and not of us. And I kind of get the picture of a mason fruit jar. There I am, and it's filled with this treasure. All these beautiful jewels are shining through. And I think God delights in working through common everyday vessels because he wants to get the glory in himself for it. And there's one version that says, in order that the treasure, or that the vessel not detract from the treasure. And I think that God delights in there being some areas of weakness in our lives in order that we not detract from the treasure. And that's why we're here, is to let Christ shine through us. It's very hard for very gifted, talented, gorgeous people to lean on God and to let him get the glory. It's very hard for them. I feel sorry for people that have a real struggle and they have a hard time coming to us.
The calendar through the eye of the needle. The rich person has a harder time seeing the
difference
for God, and the poor person can't see it much. It's just obvious.
Yeah, that's true. Well, let's see. We still have a little bit of time. I think we're going to wind up here pretty soon. But is there anything that comes to your mind that we haven't covered here that maybe is a question mark? Then I want us to spend just a few minutes in prayer, too.
Searching for the same as we are.
They just don't realize the source. how to get
the school. They very quickly don't get funded, no matter how many books they read.
I think the main way people find that, though, is what they see in us. That they see a serenity in our lives, or they see a humility. You know, what that tells them is that, hey, she's tapped into something outside of herself. And then that, in turn, creates a thirst on their heart, and want to know what that is. Sometimes we'll ask you. I had an interesting phone call with a lady one time that I never met. I still don't know who she was, but I had advertised a bed for sale, and she answered the ad and called, and she was inquiring about the bed, and I was telling her about it, and I sensed in it, you know, just some needs just in her tone of voice and what she was saying, and I was kind of trying to, I don't remember my words, but I was trying to kind of reach out to her on the phone and minister, and after we talked for a while, and she said, "Are you a Christian?" And I said, "Well, yes, how did you know?" And she said, "Well, I thought you had to be in order for you to be that interested in me." Because I didn't think anybody was a Christian would be that interested. And then we went on and talked for a while, and I just thought, interesting. You know, I can remember the day where I would not have cared two hoots about her. Mm-hmm. But, you know, God, as we grow in Him, He begins to get that focus on ourselves and more on other people. And it's so freeing. You reach out then because it's God reaching out to others to you. And then they see that. But it's something that God has to do in our lives to refocus things. But then others begin to see it and they begin to reach out. Let me just ask you a question. In the area of capacity, do you ever find yourself in a situation where you wonder why God has given you a certain job to do and yet He hasn't given you the capacity to do it? In other words, you feel it's out here and you're always here trying to handle something that's a little beyond you.
Yeah, right now we're at church, we work with junior high kids, and I think because of my personality, my husband has that personality, he's a joker and a funny man and this kind of thing, he seems to relate real well to kids, and we talk about this a lot. But I won't give up, and I think what you're saying is God's teaching me a lot through this experience. I love what I'm doing, but I don't feel like I'm adequate. I feel like I should have a total personality change to really work better with these kids. Yeah. And I just keep, you know, I even tell the college kids we're working with, gosh, I feel like I can be the resident mother, that kind of thing. And maybe that's what I'm supposed to be. Maybe I'm supposed to be the mother figure, and even for the college kids that work with us, too.
Why do you think God allows us to be in positions like
that? I think, like you said, I can see it so clearly now, so we'll lean heavily on Him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm doing a lot more of that than I ever have.
I can think of jobs my husband has had in the past, too, that were just kind of like a suit that's too big. You're not really that comfortable in it. And at the time, we just thought, Lord, why on earth did you put us here? You know, why are we doing this anyway? Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, several years will go by. And then I see what my husband's doing today in the area of counseling and shepherding of people. And I think, why? He could not do what he's doing today with any sense of compassion and understanding of other people unless he had been through these things. God put him here for a while to show him what he maybe wasn't so good at. And God put him here to stretch him and let him feel uncomfortable. So now, as these people sit down with him, he knows exactly where they are and what they're feeling, and he counsels out of a sense of experience and understanding. And I think God often will allow us to be in situations that we just think, hey, this isn't my niche. Mm-hmm. This is not me. But he's got something in mind that he's going to work through that. And to be patient with his process. Say, Lord, I don't know what you're doing, but I believe you're going to use this if I'll let you. Mm-hmm. You're going to use this in my life to bring glory to you, Lord. And that's really what I think. Mm-hmm. If you don't have anything that any outward evidence sometimes of what you're doing. We'll start off on the subject of self-image just with a few quotes from some people, just to kind of take the whole thing and put it in perspective for us. But I think often what we hear these days on this subject we get the impression that it's a very self-centered thing, and that we've got to really zero in on ourselves, and in our effort to find ourselves, we become preoccupied with ourselves. And this is not what we want to do. We want to put this thing in its context and give it a right perspective. The man who is the president of Columbia Bible College, his name is Robertson McGilkin, and he made some interesting statements that I just wanted to share with you. He said, one of the greatest threats to Christianity will be a one-sided emphasis on happiness and self-fulfillment. The last generation's emphasis was on self-denial and brokenness. And that's interesting. That's true, isn't it, as you think about it? There has been a real shift in emphasis. The new generation's emphasis is on how to feel good about ourselves and pump up our self-image. In other words, I guess what he's saying is we're more concerned with the fruit than we are the root. And God says to us in his word that if you pay attention to the root on this tree, the fruit will just automatically be there. It's just a cause and effect. But if we come preoccupied with the fruit, then we're not going to take care of the root, and the fruit will eventually wither anyway. Then the same man also made the statement. He said, modern psychology seeks to make us think we have a duty only to ourselves. I thought that was really, really quite good, the way you put that. There is an emphasis on self-acceptance instead of confession and forgiveness. Kind of the philosophy, if it feels good, do it. If not, psychoanalyze it away. And that pain and unhappiness are wrong. I think that's true. I think today it's very subtle, but it's bottom line. The feeling is that we should never be unhappy. It's wrong to be unhappy. It's wrong to go through hard things. And if you're going through this particular problem, you better find out why and get rid of it immediately, one way or another. And we don't understand that difficulties and hard things, painful things, are often and usually God's very training program for our lives. That's the way character is built in. It's not built into the soft things and the easy things. And yet, boy, we're just like that. When something hard comes, we immediately want to know what's wrong. That's our first question. And then a Dr. Kilpatrick, who's the associate professor of educational psychology at Boston College, made some good statements. He said, my observation is that Christianity, heavily swayed by psychology, tends to use psychology as a criterion by which to judge Christianity rather than the other way around. Can you see that subtle shifting there? And it can happen without us really being aware that it's happening. We find ourselves kind of poured into the world's mold, and we don't realize what has happened. It is so subtle. And yet that's exactly what's happening today. And then he goes on to say, traditional Christianity stressed keeping the beliefs and changing the behavior. Modern psychology stresses changing the beliefs and the behavior will be easier to deal with. There it is again. Just turning it completely around. And you know, it is much easier, isn't it, to change your beliefs. I mean, your behavior is much easier to handle if you can just subtly change your beliefs. And you can say to yourself, well, now, wait a minute, I don't think that's really that important. And the bottom line is that we're finding it difficult to change our behavior. So it's much, much easier to compromise and to let down and just to shift our patterns of belief in order that we don't have that struggle in our lives. And that's not the Bible. God says, you know, we must through much tribulation enter into the kingdom of God. And the whole message of the Bible is not the changing of our beliefs, our bedrock beliefs, but the changing of our behavior. Not in our own strength, but in the strength that God gives us as we surrender. And it might interest you to know that there are, at this present time, over 2,000 books on self-image on the market. Isn't that incredible? That there would be that many. But it does show that we're kind of preoccupied with this, doesn't it? It shows that there is a lot of interest in the subject. Well, let's just stop and define our term right now, the whole term self-image. And the definition that I found that I really liked, I felt like I put it in a nutshell, is self-image is the sense of value that I place on who I perceive I am. And it's an interesting statement because it says it's not the sense of value that I place on who I am, but on who I perceive that I am. And those can be two completely different things. Sometimes we have a perception of ourselves that is not accurate, and that's where we want to use the Word of God as our guide in order to bring it into alignment with what God says and thinks about us. And so that kind of leads us right into the first point, which is the reason for a shaky self-image. And here we're going to compare what the world says with what God says about this in order to try and find a balance in here. And we'll get into that comparison in a few minutes, but let's just talk just a little bit about the reason we do have a shaky self-image. One is that we listen to the wrong messages. And that's something that we all do, isn't it? Somebody makes a statement, and boy, that just really stays with us. I can remember a girl who, I guess about 6 or 7 years ago, was living in the town that Jim and I are living in, and she had come for counsel, and she really lacked confidence in herself, and she was a very slow person. Everything she did it well, but she did it very slowly. It just took ages to do anything. And as my husband and the other man that he was working with, as they talked with her, they went back into kind of her growing up years and what her relationship with her parents was like and so forth, just to get insight. And she made the comment that her nickname as she grew up was Turtle. Her parents had always called her Turtle, not her right name, Jane or whatever it was, but it was Turtle. And the reason why was because when she was little, she did have this tendency to be slow in everything she did. And so they nicknamed her that. But in nicknaming her Turtle, it was like a self-fulfilling prophecy. She lived up to her name. And she really believed in her heart that she was a very slow person. This is the way she was made, the way God made her. And that that was just her. She would always be that way. It never occurred to her that she could be different, that she could change that. And her parents certainly didn't help her, did they? They embalmed her. And so Jim and George, as they talked with her, they began to point this out to her. Hey, this is not you. You have accepted someone else's evaluation. And you can change that. You can be exactly what God wants you to be. Now, it doesn't mean that some of us aren't slower than others, but it just means that often someone else's evaluation of us can absolutely embalm us. And it's like we draw a line right there. And we don't go beyond that line. We just decide, well, this is the way it is. And I've heard people say, well, I'm sorry, but I really can't change. This is just the way I am. And boy, where does that leave God? Kind of like, well, I'm sorry, God, but
I just think it's like the redemption.
Who
won the race?
Mm-hmm.
The turtle
won the race? Yes.
Turtle.
The turtle won, that's right. Persistence there. Put that air conditioning on. How this is going to pick up. But as we share, try to speak up a little bit. I'm just not too sure of this thing. So we tend to listen to the wrong messages instead of going to God and asking Him to develop our potential. And I can say in my own life that I feel like I did this for a number of years. People would say about me, well, you're shy or you're quiet. And I was. As I was growing up, I was very shy. And I can remember walking down the street, and if there were boys, a boy or boys, coming down the sidewalk toward me, I would duck in a store. Rather than even have to walk past them. I mean, that sounds so foolish, but that's what I did. I was so self-conscious and shy that I would run from situations instead of just kind of hitting them head on. And I developed a pattern of that in my life. I actually saw that in my father, and I think that was an influence on me too. So I just learned to run from hard things. And then God led me to marry a man that would not let me run. Thank God. He began to face me with things. And he was loving about it. But, you know, his messages were, hey, we're not going to run. We're going to go through this thing, not under it, not around it, not over it. We're going to go through it. Well, that was very hard on me at first. because I had carefully developed this pattern over the years that I did not have what it took to face hard things and work through them, so I had to always look for a way around. Well, God wanted to change that image that I had of myself, and that was not glorifying to Him, so we started working on that one. These things don't go overnight, by the way. You don't become this way overnight, and they don't disappear overnight, but we need to start that pattern going in a different direction, and then over a period of years, we begin to look back and see all that God has done in our lives. Okay, another reason that our self-image is shaky is that we are looking somewhere else other than to Christ for our value. We are not looking to Him. And this is a misplaced security, and it becomes a warped image. We misplace our security. We feel like in order to feel like a secure, significant person, that we have to have a certain figure, or our hair has to be a certain way, or we have to have certain talents or abilities. And these things become so lodged in our thinking, thanks to the media and all these other influences, that we feel inferior as a person because we are looking to these things for our self-image, and we're not really looking to see what God has to say about the subject and what's important to Him. I remember as I grew up, there were certain things that I really zeroed in on in my own life, things that I felt, if these things were changed, then I would feel secure. And I remember going through high school, I had a lot of trouble with my complexion. And I just thought, if only I had a good complexion, then I'd feel secure and I'd feel like a real person, a healthy, normal person. But I never could get on top of that. It was just my chemical makeup at the time, and I had to struggle with that. So that was always a problem for me. I can remember thinking, oh, if only I had a longer waist, then I'd look like I had a decent figure. You know, all these crazy things in our mind that become big, that loom up as huge things in our mind. Maybe the way God put us together. Well, if my nose were a certain shape, or if my hair were only not so thin, or whatever it is. And we tend to really zero in on these things, and we never stop to think, hey, what's important to God? And did He have a reason for making me the way I am? Instead, we tend to argue with Him about it. Well, let's take a look at the world's evaluation of self-image and then contrast that with God's. On your notes, you'll notice that it spells the word image going down. And the only reason I did this on both of these was that I think it helps us to remember things if we have something we can hang the pegs on. So I did it that way. And the world tells us that intelligence and money and ability and good looks and environment are our position in society. Maybe the way we've grown up, the influences in our lives, either give us a good self-image or a bad self-image. If we've got all these things put together, then of course we'll have a good self-image. But do you know anyone that has them all together? I don't. Even, you'll notice sometimes even women who are beauty queens and who are interviewed, I don't know if you've ever heard any interviews of these kind of women, but there's always something about themselves that they don't like. There was an interview on 2020 show on television few years ago, and they were interviewing several of these beauty queens, and every single one of them had something about herself she didn't like. Well, my ears don't lay as flat as they should, and I don't like the texture of my hair, and my waist isn't as tiny as I wish it were. All these things, there was always something that was disturbing them about themselves. And I think the reason why is that God knows when we zero in on these things that they're very self-centered. And God did not make us in such a way that we gain security from things like that. He made us in such a way that the only way we can feel secure is by focusing on Him and not on ourselves. Because there are always going to be gaps. It's never all together. And in God's evaluation of us, He says that our self-image is to be centered in what He thinks, in what He wants of us, the way He created us and put us together. And in 1 Corinthians 1:30 says, in Him, He is the source of our wisdom, righteousness, sanctification, and redemption. But that first part, He is the source of our wisdom. And if God created me with a certain level of IQ, then what I have to say is, Lord, I can't wish I were 160 when I'm 110 or whatever it is. I have got to accept your evaluation of what's best for me. And I accept the IQ that you gave me. And I know you do not require 160 of me because you didn't give me that. Maybe you gave me 100. So that's all you require of me. And I have to feel secure in living up to, by your grace, the potential that you've given me, and to realize that you are very happy about that. And it is not honoring to you for me to try to be something I'm not, but to find out what my God-given potential is, and then to live within that boundary. And then in Philippians 4:19 it says, "My God shall supply all your needs according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus." And here, God is taking the responsibility in the realm of finances, in the realm of meeting our needs. And if he has said he will supply all our needs, then we do not have to look to things like money and finances, our resources, in order to give us a feeling of security and significance. Because God is our security. And he says, "I will give you what you need if you look to me." And I could, if there were time, I could share this, different things in my life where God has definitely met that need when I had no idea where it was coming from. I can remember times where Jim and I did not even know where next week's groceries were coming from. And, you know, if that were my security and significance, why would I have a small self-image at times? But that's not where it's to be placed. And then for God to turn around and do something miraculous, something wonderful, to show me that he really is in control, that he can supply all that I have needed, and I don't have to have certain things to feel good about myself. And then in Philippians 4:13, it says that we are able to do all things through Christ who gives us strength. And so, if I have certain abilities, praise God, I want to use them for his glory. How many people have you seen stand up and sing a solo or perform in some way? And not that you want to be a judge, but there's just not the sense that they're really doing it for God. Have you ever had that feeling? There's something missing there. And then there are other people who will stand up and perform in some way, and you sit there and you think, boy, they are really doing that for God. I can really see God in that person. And whether we have outstanding talents and abilities or not, I think God meant us to develop the potential we have. And sometimes we could just completely ignore what God has given us and not improve on it and not develop it. And I don't think that's honoring to God. But it is also not honoring to him if we take these things he's given us and use it for our own credit and glory and not for his. I have to tell you just a short little story here. There were two girls that got up to sing a solo at the Baptist Student Union a few years ago in Oklahoma. And they got up and they just couldn't get it together. They'd start off and they'd practice. But somehow they weren't able to blend their voices together and do it. And they tried three different times. And finally, one girl stepped to the microphone. And she says, "I'm really sorry, but it looks like we're not going to be able to get this together." And she said, I'm embarrassed to have to tell you this, but I think we're just going to have to sit down." And she says, "I just pray that somehow God would in some way use this for his glory." And they went and they sat down. And I sat there and I thought, you know, that took courage. Mm-hmm. Do that. And I've heard many, many solos in my life, many duets and so forth. But you know the one I remember the most is that. And I went up to the girls later and I said, "You know, I know that was difficult for you to do and that was embarrassing, but I thought the way you handled it was beautiful. You were so gracious about it and you were willing to just in humility explain the situation and just sit down without it really just devastating you." And that seemed to be encouraging to her. But I thought in any situation, you know, we may feel like we don't have the ability to do something, but to be willing to do the best we can at it and to give God the glory. This is all that he asks. And then, God delights in my beauty. That's the G on the image. God delights in my beauty. And in Psalm 45:11, says that he is thy king and he delights in thy beauty. And I love that verse. Just the fact that when God looks at me, he does not look at all these Hollywood externals and say, well, I'm not too impressed with her. She doesn't have this, this, and this, and she's missing here and here. But he looks at me, and he takes the responsibility because he created me. And he's pleased with what he sees because I've taken what he gives me, and I'm trying to use it to the maximum of his glory. And then the last point under image of how God looks at me is that in Romans 14:12 it says, everyone shall give an account of himself to God. And this is where I think we get into the area of taking risks, that we have to be willing to step out and do things that maybe are difficult for us, things that will help us in the long run develop. And I remember the first time I ever gave a public testimony. Here was this shy girl that was self-conscious and not Christ-conscious. And I died a thousand deaths before I did it anyway. But I was at a large Christian meeting. Every Friday night, they gave an opportunity for people to stand up and give a word of testimony. And so I thought about this all week, and I thought, you know, I'll never get over the shyness unless I step out and do something hard, something that I don't want to do and that is not natural to me. And so Friday night came around, and I had decided that I would quote a verse of Scripture because I didn't have to say anything original. I could just read it and sit down, and that would be it, and that would break the ice. And so I had been reading in John chapter 6 that week, and I had been impressed with verse 66. And this is where the disciples, Jesus said to the disciples, will you also go away? This is when people were leaving him, being offended at something he said. And they turned to him and they said, Lord, to whom can we go? You alone have the words of eternal life. And I was impressed with their commitment there. And so I stood up and I said, I'd like to share a verse of Scripture with you. It's found in John 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6. And I couldn't stop saying the word six. I just was like a broken record. I mean, I was just... And I felt my face get hot. I felt myself just terribly embarrassed. And there were just kind of a few little snickers in the room. And I finally got control of myself, and I finished quoting the verse. I was feeling kind of lightheaded by then. I sat down in my chair, and the first voice that came to me, which I realized was not God's voice, came to me and it said, boy, did you make a fool of yourself. You really blew it. You better not ever show your face around here again. And then the second voice that came to me said, it's all right, it'll be easier next time. And I thought, oh, that's God's voice. And you know, it was easier next time. And I also thought of something. I thought, you know, anyone sitting in this room who is shy and is afraid to stand up before a group is going to be encouraged by me, because they'll sit there and they'll think, boy, if she can blow it like that, I guess I can try. And so, but that really did break the ice for me. And there were other times after that where I felt that I didn't do a super job, but it was an icebreaker. I was launching out into an area where I was uncomfortable, and yet I had to learn to take those risks in order to improve on the talent God gave me, in order to break out of that and let God do something in my life more than he'd done before. And as long as you stay within that safety zone, then God never has a chance to develop you in other areas. And you know, the best way to find out what you're good at is to find out what you're not good at. It's kind of like the young growing executive who went to the older man who was very successful, had been for years. And he said, sir, what is the reason for your success? And the man says, well, the reason I'm so successful is because of experience. And he said, oh, really? He says, well, what kind of experience have you had? And he said, well, bad experience. In other words, he said, I learned by making mistakes, by doing things wrong. And that's how I learned what I can do. What I can do right is through the bad experiences I had. And I think we have to be willing, you know, for God to take us through those hard things in order to find out what we can do. And to not let them devastate us, but just to say, Lord, thanks for the lesson. And now I think maybe I might not want to do that as much, and I might want to concentrate more in this area here. But that's how we learn. God gave us the potential every one of us to be a beautiful person. And this starts on the inside. Some of the most beautiful people that I have known over the years are people that would walk in a room and you might not look twice at them. You might not be that impressed. My own mother is this way. My mother is not a very attractive person outwardly, and she's rather quiet person. But I'll tell you, she is 14 karat gold. I would hold her up against anybody. And I've said over the years, many, many times, if I could just turn out half like my mother, I'd feel like a success. And I love her. I admire her. She has inner qualities in her life. She is a patient person. She is a loving person, a giving, serving person. And when people get to know her, when they've been around her for a while and get to know her, they're impressed. They're very impressed with her. And to me, my mother, I can honestly say that she is the most beautiful person I know. And I want to be that way. I don't want my security to rest in externals to where I'm always nervous and anxious and feeling like I'm not quite as good as I wish I were on the outside. But I would like God to develop inner qualities in my life. When these are built up, then there is a security there because you're placing it on God's values and not these others that are so shaky. Well, let's talk about the destroyers of self-image. What are some of these things that destroy our self-image? One of the things, and we've already mentioned this, but we'll talk about it a little bit more, is what people think. We automatically are vulnerable, aren't we, in this area? We're so caught up with what people think of us. And in 1 Samuel 17, 28. Let me just read this verse. It says, when Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? Do you think he was really concerned about the sheep? There was a jealousy here. I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Now here was another person's evaluation of David, that he was one, conceited, and two, that he was wicked. He was a bad person. And if David had let that devastate him, it would have affected his ability to be what God wanted him to be. But fortunately, he didn't let that affect him, and he went on to be what God wanted him to be. And the Bible also talks about the fear of man brings a snare. And then another destroyer of self-image is not necessarily what other people think, but what I think of myself. And this can be equally devastating because it is not necessarily what God thinks of all. And let's turn to Exodus chapter 4, verse 10 to 12. Moses said to the Lord, O Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. Moses may have had a stutter. It's not really clear whether he did or not, but he was slow of speech and tongue, and this was an embarrassment to him. The Lord said to him, who gave man his mouth? In other words, God saying, who made you that way? Do you have an argument with me, Moses? Did I make a mistake? Did I reach down and just scrape the bottom of the barrel when I put you together? Could there be a reason that I allowed you to be this way? And then he goes on to say, who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go. I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. Do you see what's happening here? God is saying to Moses, I know you're slow of speech, but remember, I made you that way. And Moses, do you think there's a reason that I may have made you that way? It's in order that as you go, you would lean on me for your support and not on your gift and not on your ability. I want you to learn to lean hard on me, because I'm going to be the one to teach you what to say. And how many people have you seen who have outstanding gifts and abilities, maybe in speaking or singing or organizing or whatever it is, and do not realize the importance of leaning hard on God because they already feel confident in that particular area. They do not feel the need to lean hard on God. And that's why sometimes these weaknesses in our lives are like a blessing in disguise. We tend to think of them as a liability. But they really, when you stop and think about it, any area of innate weakness in your life is really probably a blessing in disguise, if we'll let it be. If we'll look at that area and say, Lord, I would not have chosen this myself. But Lord, I can see that if I give this to you and if I lean hard on you in this area in my life, then that is going to deepen my relationship with you. And if I'm more dependent on you, then that's going to give you an opportunity to shine through my life. But if I take the spotlight, then they're not going to see you. They're going to see me. And we're so good at taking the spotlight. We want the spotlight, don't we? But God often gives us areas of liability in order to teach us to lean hard on him and to let him be the one who's in the spotlight. Okay, another destroyer of self-image is in our past experiences. And Philippians 3:13, Paul says, forgetting those things which are behind, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus my Lord. And so there it is, just in a few words, forgetting those things which are behind. Paul had learned to do that. And you know, Paul had a thorn in the flesh. There's debate among Bible scholars as to what that was. I personally feel very strongly that it had to do with his eyes because of some statements that he made. As he was writing one of his letters, he says, you see with what large letters I write. And things like that, to where he may have had, in another place, he says to the people he's talking to, he said, you felt so sorry for me that if possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. So there, it seems to me that there was a physical disability there that was evidently embarrassing to Paul, and it caused other people to feel sorry for him. But then he goes on to say that he asked God 3 times to take away that area of liability in his life. Lord, please change this about me. It's embarrassing, and I'm not comfortable with it. We can even say to God, Lord, I don't think this helps your cause. I'm not able to minister to people as well because of this liability. And God turns around and says, nope. You can argue with me on it, but I want it this way. And then Paul came to the conclusion, he says, but God said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. And he's saying, I planned it this way. I planned that area of weakness in your life because that's how my grace is going to be seen through you to other people. And the whole reason I put you in this world is not to make you feel good and comfortable, but it's for you to tie in on my great overall purposes in this world. It's for you to fit into my plan, not for me to fit into your plan. And we forget this, don't we? We get it just completely turned around, that we're to be a part of his great planning. And when God made us a certain way, he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly where we wanted to fit in and how he wanted us to minister. And I have found, I don't know about you, but I have found in my own life that I usually minister more through weakness in my life than I do through strength. If I'll give God all the pieces. And God's taking me through some things these last 2 years where there have been several times where I have just said, Lord, I know you're with me, but I really don't have any outward evidence of that. I just, you know, I'm frustrated. I don't know how to handle the situation, Lord. I don't know what to do. And I'm uncomfortable. And I don't like it, Lord. But I had to come back and say, but somehow you know what you're doing. You've got a plan in my life. And it's making me lean harder on God than I've ever had to lean before. You know, we don't like to be uncomfortable, do we? We want to be together. We want to have everything together. But God will put us in positions of weakness in our lives in order to make us look only to him, not the people, not the circumstances, but only to him. We're in a situation where we can't control things, and oh, how we would love to control it. I would. Always want to be in control. But God, every once in a while, throws me off balance, and I squirm. And sometimes I argue. But I always have to come back to the place, Lord, I've got to say yes to you in this. And I pray that you'd be glorified in my life. And then you'll lead me to people here and there who have maybe been in a similar situation and they're hurting. And I would never be able to minister to those people out of strength. It's out of my weakness then that I can minister to them. Because when they're pouring out their hearts to me, I can sit there and say, well, I know what you mean. God has taken me through the valley of something similar to that. So God knows what he's doing. And then another destroyer of self-image is just in the area that we've already talked about of our present liabilities, and that's where I mentioned we have a running argument with God over something we will not turn loose of. We're insisting on something in our lives. We're demanding something that God has already said no to, or that he has decided it's going to be a certain way. In Romans 9:20, this is a beautiful verse on this. It says, know, O man or woman, let's say because we're all women, nay, O man, but who are you to reply against God? Who are we to argue with God? And so, we find ourselves going through life with these running arguments. And it goes on to say, shall the thing formed say to him that made it, why have you made me this way? Have you ever said that to God? Why did you make me that way, Lord? Then the last point under destroyers of self-image is in a lack of surrender in our hearts. And this is where it may have to do with people in our lives. It may have to do with our relationship with our husband. Maybe we feel that God has shortchanged us. And he's put us with this man that is passive and is not a good communicator, and we long for communication. And we constantly feel kind of like we're a little bit thwarted and like we're being held back by this person. Or maybe he's given us a difficult child to deal with. And we just think, Lord, why did you let this happen in my life? And we're not surrendering ourselves to the obvious will of God in our lives. I got together with a friend of mine in Colorado Springs a few months ago, and we ended up laughing. But we were talking about some struggles that at the time we were going through with our daughters. And she was kind of sharing what she was going through with her daughter, and I was sharing what I was going through with mine. And I just stopped and laughed, and I said, you know something? I think God got us mixed up. I think I could cope with your daughter. And she laughed and said, well, I think I could cope better with yours than mine. And it was so funny. And then as we talked, we said, you know, that's exactly why God did it the way he did. Because if we felt adequate, then there would be no leaning on God. There'd be no crying out, Lord, you've got to do this. I can't do it myself. And so God planned it that way, in order to teach us humility and brokenness so that he gets all the glory. And then in time, he takes those pieces, if we'll give him all the pieces, and he puts that together, that relationship. Then some repairers of self-image. Let's talk about these for a minute. The first thing that we need to look at is the first repair of our self-image is to look to Christ. And Hebrews 12:2 says, looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. He's the one that creates us in the first place, and then he is the one who takes the responsibility to perfect us in him. And then the second is to take responsibility in our lives. And boy, I can't underscore this too much, the importance of this. Learning to take responsibility. This has to do with judging ourselves in a situation. In 1 Corinthians 11:31, it says, for if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. I don't know if you've ever thought about that verse and what it really means. But if I will judge myself in a situation, then God will not have to judge me. If I do not judge myself, then I put myself in a position of being under his judgment. And that means when I'm in a situation, I need to say, Lord, what am I doing here that is wrong or that needs to be changed? How is my attitude wrong? But do you know what my first tendency is? Is to put that spotlight on another person, whether it's my husband or my child or whoever it is. And I begin to I shy away from responsibility. And I can remember an area of my life where I really struggled with this for years, literally for years. And that was just in making excuses for myself. I would borrow the car, use the car rather, and we only have one car. We've kind of been a one-car family. And Jim would say, well, will you be home by 3:15 because I have an appointment and I'll need the car. And I'd say, oh, sure, I'll be back. So I would go shopping, and I would be having such a good time that I would just procrastinate on how long it would take me to get home. And so here I would be coming in at 3:30 instead of 3:15. And as I would come in the door, I would say, oh, honey, I am so sorry, but, oh, you wouldn't believe the traffic. It was awful. I had been here on time, but... And here were all these excuses. And this was a pattern in my life. It just, you could just count on it like clockwork. I always had a reason. In fact, my husband asked me one time, he says, why didn't you ever say I'm sorry, I was wrong? But I couldn't do that. You see, I developed the habit of defending myself. I couldn't be honest in this area of my life. It was too intimidating to me. And so one day I said to Jim, I said, honey, you know, I've been this way for years. I know I make excuses for myself. But I have been this way so long that I honestly don't know if I can change. And he says, well, he said, you can change, honey. But he says, what you'll have to do is you'll have to stop and judge yourself every time there's a tendency to make an excuse. And he says, I think if you'll stop and take responsibility, that God will begin to help you in that area of your life. But you've got to take responsibility for it. You've got to admit when you're wrong. And he says, I think when you do, God will begin to give you a blinking yellow light in your life, kind of a caution light, kind of an, uh-oh, here it comes again. And he says, even if you go ahead and blow it, he says, if you'll just stop and confess it at that point, and you just keep doing that, he says, then God will begin to help you catch it ahead of time. And you know, I found that true in my life when I began to start saying, honey, I'm sorry. The reason I was late getting home was because I was having a good time and I just didn't want to leave sooner. And I'm sorry. Now I've inconvenienced you and made you late, and I'm sorry. See, that's all I had to do instead of making an excuse. And boy, I tell you, that was so freeing in my life. And when I began to change the pattern of that weak area of my life, I began to feel better about myself. You know, when you take responsibility, you do feel better about yourself. And Jay Adams, who is a well-known Christian psychologist, made the statement that we feel well because we do well. And what he is saying is if you will do the right things, you will feel good about yourself. But you have to change that pattern. And in fact, in Genesis 4, 6, and 7, when God was talking to Cain after he had become angry with Abel because his gift was accepted and Cain's was not, God said to Cain, why are you angry and why are you depressed? Anger and depression are often evidence of a bad self-image, that we do not feel good about ourselves. So God said, why are you angry and why are you depressed? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must conquer it. You must conquer it. You must take the responsibility there. And then another repair of our self-image is just to move ahead, as we talked about before, to tackle areas that are difficult for us, to do something very hard that we would rather not do. And this may have to do with just keeping short accounts with people. It may have to do with going to another person and asking forgiveness. And that can be a very, very difficult thing to do. It may have to do with forgiving someone else, maybe who should have asked you for forgiveness and has not. But in your heart, being willing to say, Lord, I forgive that person, not because they deserve it, but because you've forgiven me of so much, therefore, I'm willing to forgive them too on that basis. And so, to go ahead and, in a sense, to clear the debris out of our lives so that God can begin to speak to us we feel then good about ourselves because we've been obedient to God. And then another thing is to concentrate on others. And this is next to looking to Jesus, I think this is the most important one of all, to ask God to develop us in the area of being a servant, always being on the lookout for other people and what their needs are. You know, you can walk into a room full of people and you can approach it.